I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Apparently, being a top American banker means never having to say you're sorry. Today, the CEOs of 8 American banks are on Capitol Hill to answer two questions. Are they lending the more than $160 billion in government bailout money they've received, as they were supposed to? And are they sorry for their bad investments, which have taken down the economy? Yesterday, British bankers were raked over the coals by their lawmakers and did offer up mea culpas.
We are profoundly, and I think I would say unreservedly, sorry.
And there is a profound and unqualified apology for all of the distress that has been caused.
I'm very sorry what's happened at HBOS. It has affected shareholders, many of whom are colleagues.
But this morning, in their prepared remarks, no apologies from American bankers. Lloyd Blankfein, chair and CEO of the Goldman Sachs Group, perhaps came the closest.
Many people believe, and in many cases justifiably so, that Wall Street lost sight of its larger public obligations and allowed certain trends and practices to undermine the financial system's stability. We have to regain the public's trust and do everything we can to help mend our financial system to restore stability and vitality.
Well, apparently American bankers have learned one lesson. Unlike auto executives who took corporate jets to their first bailout hearing, bank executives arrived in D.C. on charter flights and Amtrak. Well, Steve Guyman is an editor at the finance team, on the finance team at Bloomberg News Service. And Steve, you say, I mean, we haven't been, listening to every single second, but you say there may have been one other more humble comment from a bank CEO?
Yes, Robin, good to be with you this afternoon. Vikram Pandit, who is the chief executive officer of Citigroup, he's been in the position a little over a year, said that the bank recognizes this is a new reality. The environment is different. The conditions are different. And he actually said he's going to forego any bonuses and only take a $1 a year salary until Citigroup becomes profitable. That's as close as anybody has come to saying we get it and we're adjusting our operations accordingly.
But, it's still not an apology. And the reason I mention it is that, there's been a steady drumbeat of people wanting to hear that. We mentioned yesterday op-ed writers in the Los Angeles Times saying, I want Barney Frank, who's the chair of the Financial Services Committee, I want him wearing a barbecue apron instead of a gavel. I want him wielding a barbecue fork the size of a trident. People wanted a really tough tongue lashing and an apology from bankers. What are we missing here? Why is the tone not as harsh?
Well, the bankers in their prepared testimony and in the question and answering that is likely to go on for the rest of today on Capitol Hill, the bankers are saying the money they receive from the government, in some cases money they did not request or did not seek, is being used to the purposes that were originally intended by Congress. That is, to continue to maintain and in some cases to increase the amount of loans, the number of loans that these banks are making. So that to the extent that these bankers are explaining what they've done with the money, they feel that their actions have been within the purview of what Congress had requested.
Do we understand yet then why there seems to be a disconnect? If they say they are loaning that money, why isn't it being felt on the other end? Why is there still a credit a freeze?
Well, it may be that the solution that was crafted last year was inadequate to get the markets unclogged, to get the credit going again. I think the public anger about what's going on in the financial industry, and to the extent that Barney Frank articulated this, people don't understand why people who are running banks are paid bonuses that are, in some cases, millions or tens of millions of dollars on an annual basis. Frank, at the very beginning of the hearing, in his opening remarks, talked about that and asked each of the members to provide an explanation for why they're being compensated as a bonus when they're already receiving salaries that are hundreds of thousands of dollars, and in a couple of cases, for people sitting on the panel, $1 million a year.
Well, I think I think the wording he used, too, was why do you need to be bribed, as he called it, with bonuses to do the thing you're paid to do?
That was his words. And he also, by the way, talking about these 8 executives of banks appearing before the committee, said, this is a fun job, except at a time like this. This is not an amusement park.
Well, I understand, too, there was a new wrinkle in the question of bonuses. New York Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney asked about a new complaint from New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, who claims that Bank of America was apparently complicit in the huge bonuses that Merrill Lynch executives received in the days before Bank of America took over Merrill Lynch. Now, CEO Ken Lewis, we know today, said his personal involvement in this was limited and his company didn't have authority over that. But still, the charges being brought. And we thought that we heard more recently that CEO Lewis of Bank of America fired John Thain of Merrill Lynch in part out of anger over the huge bonuses. So You know, are we hearing that Bank of America may have blessed them?
Well, actually, what Ken Lewis said in answer to some of the questions from the members of Congress was that they had asked Merrill Lynch to roll back some of those bonuses that were being paid out to the Merrill workers. That's an issue that's still evolving as this hearing goes on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. We also understand Barney Frank asked for a foreclosure moratorium. What was the sense of that conversation?
I think that's another thing that's still to be worked out later today. I will say that in another part of Washington today, the Office of Thrift Supervision has asked all of the banks that it regulates, basically savings and loan associations, to halt on foreclosure activities until the plan that the Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner outlined yesterday is able to be put into place. As you may recall, there were a number of details left to be resolved as the government, the Obama administration, picks up where the Bush administration left off at the change of administration.
Well, and just briefly, Timothy Geithner, Secretary of Treasury Geithner's plan was roundly criticized today. Although, there's been one or two supportive voices, but is there a sense of disappointment in that, the reception of that plan?
At this point, both the markets and people on Capitol Hill are waiting for those additional details to be provided by the Obama administration and the Treasury Department.
Steve Guymon, an editor at Bloomberg News Service, following the hearings on Capitol Hill, 8 top CEOs, bank CEOs, appearing before Congress today. Steve, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
My pleasure.
Well, Doug Chafin is a bank CEO, but he's not testifying before Congress, and his bank is not taking bailout funds. Even though Monroe Bank and Trust is in Michigan, home of the auto industry, and that state ranks 6th among all states in foreclosures last year, with more than 145,000 people losing their homes, up 2% from 2007. For one thing, Doug's bank is doing better because, like many regional banks, Doug Chafin's didn't get involved in packaging and reselling their mortgages. They know exactly where those mortgages are. Doug joins us. And, Doug, I understand you recently pulled your bank's application for the TARP or bailout money. Explain why.
Well, there's a cost to that funding. In our case, it would cost our shareholders over $1.5 million in the dividends that we would pay the U.S. Treasury annually, plus dilute the ownership of the stock that they do hold. But frankly, the primary reason is that we just don't need it. We are well-funded, we're well-capitalized, and there's no need to take on that cost if we can meet the needs of our customers here as it is. We all have our share of problems. In our local market, we have a 12% unemployment rate currently, which means more and more borrowers don't have the ability to repay us. However, we for years have maintained a pretty strong capital level.
Is part of that the fact that Michigan had a taste of the recession before anybody?
We started well ahead of the game. I think some of the estimates go back as early as 2001 when we started to see declines in employment in our state, and we've been in it ever since.
What about the thinking that banks should be required to renegotiate loans that are in trouble, that judges actually should be given the authorization to renegotiate loans as they do in some bankruptcies now? What do you think of that?
Well, first and foremost, no bank wants to foreclose. No bank wants to take someone's home. That is the last, absolutely last resort. And every single banker is working hard one-on-one with our customers to try to come up with some kind of solution that makes sense for them. We're talking to customers about their needs. We're talking to customers about changes in their income, changes in their financial status. And where we can possibly do that, we renegotiate those on a one-on-one basis.
So you're renegotiating loans?
Yeah, we're doing that now. You bet.
Yeah.
Every day.
And are you allowing homeowners to sell for whatever the market will bear so you can get anything, or are you insisting that you try to get something? How do you navigate that?
Well, that's a negotiated issue. I think by and large, we are going to what the market is. There's obviously a difference of opinion what that market is, but we talk about that every single day.
And how do you reach people in trouble? I mean, we read that some lenders are sending realtors out, sort of a boots-on-the-ground approach to, you know, knock on doors and get to borrowers. Tell us more about that.
Well, that is happening in some markets, and I know that there are a couple of markets in Michigan where that's happening. And in our case, we'll actually send an officer out on occasion if that's the only way to get hold of someone. And hopefully people will open the door.
Because you want to tell them what? Hey, it's not, you know, we're not necessarily going to take your house away. That's not the first thing we want to do?
That is exactly the message. That is not never our first option. We want to talk about their situation and what we can do to restructure it so it makes some sense for them.
There have been housing activists protesting. They just started outside of the heads of some top banks here on the East Coast, angry that they won't renegotiate some of these mortgages. Are you feeling the anger aimed at you? Bankers have been all painted with the same brush.
Well, no, not really. You know, this is, you know, Monroe is a small town. I live here, work here, go to church here. I have breakfast with my customers at the local coffee shop, walk across the street to the diner, have lunch with them. They understand the challenges, and they understand we're trying to help them.
This is Doug Chafin, President and Chief Executive of Monroe Bank and Trust in Michigan. He's also Chair of the Michigan Bankers Association. And we're speaking to you, Doug, because, of course, the government is talking about funneling more money into banks to free up credit. What do you think the answer to the issue is?
Well, I don't think there's a silver bullet, quite frankly. I wish there was. It's going to take a combination of trying to shore up the financial markets to rebuild confidence in those markets. It's going to take stimulus to encourage businesses to grow and to hire people and put people back to work. I don't have all the answers. I'm not sure that anyone has all those answers today. So we're anxious to see what the result of the programs that are being proposed are.
But it sounds like funneling money into banks will do nothing unless people have jobs.
Well, that's exactly right. No amount of funding can force someone to borrow money to buy a car or force someone to borrow money to buy a home. The fact of the matter is that bank lending never precedes a recovery. It always follows a recovery. So we're anxious for our local customers to get back to work and get back to growing the economy again.
Yeah, so you don't see it as much of bankers not willing to make loans as people not having the wherewithal, the jobs and things to take out loans.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. People are naturally going to be cautious in an environment like this. And in fact, banks are making loans. Two-thirds of the credit market really come from non-bank sources. Banks, traditional banks, are the remaining third, and loans nationwide grew with banks in 2008. So we are in the business of lending. That's how we make money. We're ready, willing, and able to do that. We just need to see greater demand for it.
Well, that's funny, and it prompts one last question because, as you know, President Obama was in Elkhart, Indiana the other day, where there's huge unemployment because the RV factory is completely slowed down, and they say it's because people with excellent credit can't get loans to buy the RVs. They say credit's tight.
There may be some isolated cases where the availability of credit has dried up, but in those cases, it's primarily due to the secondary market, the capital market, that doesn't have the funding available.
In other words, the regional bank itself may not have the money, and then it can't get the money from a secondary lender.
Or they traditionally receive that from secondary lenders,
right,
such as the mortgage market.
Doug Chafin, President and Chief Executive of Monroe Bank and Trust in Michigan. Thanks so much for speaking with us, and best to you.
Thank you, Robin.
Let's check in on Israel now, where both Tzipi Livni, head of the center-right Kadima Party, and Benjamin Netanyahu, one of the conservative leaders of the Likud Party, are claiming victory after yesterday's inconclusive parliamentary elections. While no single party won a decisive victory, conservative and hard-right parties took a clear majority of votes, with a relatively new ultra-nationalist party pushing the left-of-center Labor Party, which led Israel for decades, down to fourth place. So, with nationalist religious parties holding the critical swing votes needed to form any government, where does Israel, where does the U.S., go from here? Aaron David Miller is a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. He joins us from his office and has written, advised, six administrations on Arab-Israeli negotiations. His latest book is The Much Too Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. So, Aaron, where are we? We've been watching the rise of the Israel Beitenu party, led by charismatic Avigdor Lieberman, for a while now. Tell us about that party and about him.
Well, Lieberman's rise, I think, reflects a number of realities which really cut to the core of the current problem. Number one, you're dealing with a group of political leaders who basically have none of the political authority, the historic legitimacy, or the moral authority that the founding generation of Israel had. And you've had Israeli prime ministers, Netanyahu, Barak, Olmert, who have stumbled and fumbled in matters of peace and war. And they don't inspire much confidence. Somebody like Lieberman, who is not new, but who is quite fresh and bold in his perspective, he emphasizes both civil unions, that is to say non-religiously sanctioned marriages in Israel, which is a very popular issue, particularly for secular immigrants who cannot get married. He plays on the fears of Israelis against their Israeli-Arab citizens of the state, and has proposed actually transferring their areas to a Palestinian state.
He's also said he wants the Arabs who remain in Israel to take a loyalty oath.
Right, and certainly those Arab political parties who are competing in the Knesset, even though the Israeli Supreme Court has struck that down. Plus, he reflects a tough security-minded policy, even though he does support a two-state solution to the conflict, at least nominally. He reflects the tough-minded security posture, which most Israelis can relate to. So Lieberman's rise reflects the fact that he stole votes from the Likud, he's going to be a force. Now, whether or not he is included in the next Israeli government is really the key issue right now.
Well, you say, you know, he stole from the Likud, but his ultra-nationalist party is also one that pushed the left-of-center Labor Party, which is, you know, governed Israel for decades and was closely associated with the country's founders, down to fourth place. Is it fair to say that we're pretty much seeing, you know, it's obviously the decline over years of the traditional left in Israel, but is it the death? I mean, what are we seeing there?
Well, the traditional left in Israel, has frankly it's a much misunderstood force. I mean, the history of Israeli peacemaking is not a history of the left. It's a history of the right. From Menachem Begin, who is still the only prime minister ever to make significant territorial concessions to an Arab state, and he made his deal with Sadat, to Yitzhak Shamir, who was pushed for sure to participate in the Madrid Peace Conference, even to Yitzhak Rabin, who was a center-right labor politician, to Ehud Olmert, who was first a member of the Likud, created a new party, Kadima, to Ariel Sharon. All of the actual walking, quote unquote, has been done by the center right on peace.
Is this sort of Nixon is the guy who can go to China?
Yeah, in a way, if all the walking has been done by the center right, then all the talking has been done by the Israeli left. So, I situate the current circumstances in a tradition, a long-standing tradition of peacemaking within Israel. It's just now. The fundamental reason you produce the electoral results that Israel produced is that Israelis are not moved, inspired by their political leaders. And Israel is in a transition from this founding generation that you referred to a generation of politicians who are prisoners rather than masters of their constituencies.
Well, this is a real broad view that I'm going to ask of you, but are you saying that it's possible that we're at a moment in time where a longtime hawk could emerge as a leader and end up being the one who pulls Israel's troops and settlements out of Gaza?
Well, out of the West Bank. The reality is it's conceivable, although I don't see the opportunity on the Israeli-Palestinian track. I think the chances of producing an Israeli-Palestinian conflict-ending agreement, I'll choose my words carefully, which addresses borders, Jerusalem, refugees, and security, the chances of that happening are slim to none. There is an opportunity, however, for an Israeli-Syrian agreement. And it may well be that a national unity government with both Kadima and Likud in a rotating agreement on, and there's precedent for this, on a sequential approach to who would become prime minister, it's conceivable, hard, but conceivable that you could have some serious progress with the Syrians.
No. Well, and I apologize for misspeaking. I, of course, meant the West Bank where there are settlements, Gaza where there aren't, and where there was a recent war. Just briefly, your thoughts on how that invasion in Gaza in response to Gazan missiles affected the outcome of this vote?
You know, the interesting thing is Ehud Barak, who, from a military perspective, I don't want to get into the political implications because I think they were pretty disastrous for the Israelis. But in comparison with the summer 2006 war against Hezbollah, the Israeli Defense Forces, even while they ended up killing a lot of innocent people, 1,300 and wounded 5,000, seemed to have achieved their military objectives. And Ehud Barak, who was the architect as Minister of Defense of that policy, fared very poorly. And I think that reflects a couple things. It reflects the demise, or at least the profound weakening of the Labor Party, which he heads. And second, it reflects the fact that most Israelis, even while they may have applauded the Israeli Defense Forces' performance, saw Gaza as a wash. Hamas remains resilient and strengthened. And I'm not sure most Israelis see this as a victory.
That's Aaron David Miller from the Woodrow Wilson International Center. He has advised 6 administrations on Arab-Israeli negotiations. His book, The Much-Too-Promised Land, America's Elusive Search for Arab-Israeli Peace. We don't know the outcome in Israel, which is usually the end of any discussion on Israel. But Aaron, thanks so much for joining us today.
Robin, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, back after the news here and now. Taxes are bad and they're always too high. That's a sentiment you may agree with, and it's certainly been a bumper sticker for a while now. But Matt Miller says it's a dead idea, that Republicans as well as Democrats know that taxes are going to go up and it will be good. Matt Miller was a senior advisor in the Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration. His new book is The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. And Matt joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Okay, make your case right off the top to those who might be saying, aha, he was in the Clinton administration, he's a bleeding heart liberal, he's on one side of the aisle. You quote 3 prominent Republican number crunchers, and they all tell you what?
They all say that taxes are going to go up no matter who's in power in the next decade. This is really part of what I'm trying to say is a bunch of old ways of thinking that we are stuck in. This whole idea of dead ideas means that we're in the grip of these ideas that may be decades old on both sides of the aisle, may have made sense at one point, you know, years and years ago, but with all the changes we're going through with the current economic crisis, with the globalization that's going on, rapid technological change, we have to update these old ideas if we're going to renew the kind of prosperity and get out of the ditch that we've been driven into by a lot of these old ways of thinking, and taxes is a perfect example. Right now, we're going to cut taxes, obviously, to try and muscle our way through this recession, but as John McCain's top advisors tell me in the book, once the boomers start to retire, which is imminent, taxes are going to go up no matter who's in power, because we're going to double the number of people on Social Security and Medicare. And we've already got $50 trillion in unfunded promises in those programs. The math doesn't work.
And these people that talk to you include Douglas Holtz-Aiken, a former budget director. Who else?
Dan Crippen, who's another Congressional Budget Office head. David Walker, who was a Republican appointee to run the General Accountability Office. All impeccable credentials. They don't like to say this in public because there's a sort of tax police on the Republican side that basically inhibits honest discussion of all this stuff. And then Democrats are inhibited, too, because if Republicans have been beating Democrats over the head with a club on the tax issue for 30 years, the Democrats are cowed about talking honestly about this, too. But behind closed doors, both sides know that as the boomers age, the taxes are going to go up. And that's an opportunity to actually rethink how we tax ourselves, to do it in ways that are better for the economy. And that means, to me, cutting payroll taxes, which are regressive and job-killing.
Regressive meaning?
It has a bigger impact on poor people. And raising taxes on things like dirty energy that we need to shift away from for environmental reasons as well.
In other words, using taxes to help people make better choices as well.
Exactly. While we're raising the money we need to have the government we want.
Well, you say that this thinking is based on economic law, you know, quote unquote, that all economists know, something called Wagner's Law.
Otto von Bismarck's top economist was a man named Adolf Wagner, and he realized back in the 1880s, this is when Bismarck was first with the Kaiser introducing the first models of what became Social Security later around the world in Germany, he realized that as countries got richer, they wanted to spend more on the things that only people could do collectively, like better schools, better police protection, pensions, health care, and that meant that over time, as civilizations got wealthier, they would tend to have higher spending and higher taxes on these kind of collective goods, and that's basically predicted what's happened over the last 100 years or so. And that doesn't mean that taxes should go up to, you know, 90% rates, obviously, but it just means that in a decent society, over time, people come to realize that there are things we can do together that we can't do alone, and that's government's part of that.
You say pretty much all successful countries have higher taxes.
The richer you are as a country, the higher your taxes and the higher your spending is as a share of your economy, because you're buying these things that we can do together.
Well, I'm hearing the response from those adamantly against taxes. Don't take my money and just spend it frivolously on welfare cheats. I'm sick of underwriting bad programs. I mean, you know, there are a lot of Americans angry about taxes.
And understandably, because there's a fair amount of waste in the federal government, and we should go after that. I'm not advocating higher taxes in the book. I'm trying to offer a guide to the future. We're already trillions in debt. We can't continue to put all this stuff on our kids or to continue to expect China to finance our retirement programs. And so the question is, how should we tax ourselves in ways that are best or least harmful for the economy? We can actually improve the economy by taxing ourselves more smartly.
Talk about some other ways that you and others think we could tax smartly.
The best way, I think, is to cut taxes on things like payrolls and corporations, because those hurt jobs and hurt growth, and raise taxes on things like dirty energy and on consumption, because those are the things at the margin we would rather discourage. And it's a better way to finance the government that we need. It'll create more jobs. It will assure longer-term growth, and is a way to use the fact that taxes, unfortunately, will have to go up to actually get a bigger benefit for society and for all of us.
And when you say taxes on consumption, what do you mean?
Things like the value-added tax that they have in Europe, which the VAT. Larry Summers, the current White House economic advisor, has a great quip about that. He says, we don't have a VAT today because conservatives think it's a money machine and liberals think it's regressive, that it's worse for has a worse impact on lower-income people. He says, we'll get a VAT when liberals realize it's a money machine and conservatives realize it's regressive. And I think that's something like the case, and liberals should be reassured that as long as something like a VAT or a consumption tax is part of an overall system where we're also doing things like universal health coverage or more generous pension support from the government, the overall system is progressive, even if a consumption tax in some ways has a higher impact on lower income people.
And when you say the overall system is progressive, you mean that it will affect wealthier people more. But give me an example of a VAT tax. What would it be on?
On goods and goods and services, as is the case in virtually every other country. Every other advanced country has a consumption tax like this, except for the United States.
Well, but wait a second. You know, people have to buy things. And we want people to buy things. We want, you know, consumer confidence to go back up. We know it's been plunging. Why would we discourage people from doing that by adding a tax?
It's not discouraging. It's just we have to raise revenue some way. And so the question is, what are the least bad ways to raise the revenue we need to have the government we want? We want our parents to have some kind of health care through Medicare. We want seniors to have some kind of security through Social Security. We want to have some kind of support for schools. We want national defense. We're going to have to raise the money somehow. What are the best, least harmful ways to the economy to do that? My own view is cutting taxes on payroll. The payroll tax is the worst tax. More people pay more in payroll tax than they do in income tax, and that's crazy.
Well, and you talk about how taxes, you know, you can't rob incentive through taxes. In other words, I mean, somebody, I think you quote Ronald Reagan saying that he would stop working at a certain point in a year when he was making films because he knew he was going to get into a tax bracket where it wasn't worth it for him.
That's right. Now, taxes are not the only dead idea I'm talking about in the book. I think it's part of a broader way that we have dated thinking on healthcare, on education, on trade. And if we don't update our thinking on these old ideas, we won't get where we need to coming out of this recession.
That's Matt Miller. His book is The Tyranny of Dead Ideas, Letting Go of the Old Ways of Thinking to Unleash a New Prosperity. Matt's also host of the public radio program Left, Right, and Center, if his voice sounds familiar to you. Matt, thanks so much for coming in to speak with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a while, so let's turn a few minutes of the program over to your thoughts. Melissa Owsley of Waterford, Michigan, wrote after our segment on those California octuplets. We spoke with an ethicist and doctor about whether there should be legal restrictions on, as I said, implanting multiple embryos during in vitro fertilization. As it stands, there are just guidelines. Well, Melissa writes, first of all, doctors don't implant embryos. They transfer embryos in hopes one will implant. But further, micromanaging people fertility is on par with banning abortion. The only thing regulation would accomplish would be more infertility tourism, as has happened in Europe, which would lead to even more multiple births. Well, we also spoke recently about a last-minute reprieve for Philadelphia libraries, which were almost closed down because of a budget shortfall. Afterwards, we heard from listeners in Josephine County, Oregon, whose libraries did close after a property tax levy was voted down. They formed a citizens group and decided to run the libraries themselves with 250 volunteers and a public radio model in which members pay a fee to join, but libraries are open to everyone. Doug Walker is with Josephine Community Libraries. Doug, how's it going?
Oh, it's wonderful so far. We've managed to get the doors open again after being closed for a year and a half, and we've just recently got the library up and running again at about 20 hours a week. Seems to be going real well for us right now.
How much did you raise?
So far, we've raised about $380,000 in memberships and donations, and a little bit of that was grants.
Do you ever find yourselves thinking, wait a second, this shouldn't be this way? It's great that you got the libraries open, but, you know, this is what taxes are for.
Yeah, I think that way all the time, and I wonder sometimes whether we've done the right thing or not in allowing the citizens of the county that aren't donating to have a library or have the benefits of the library without paying anything for it. It's a hard one to say. I have 2 7-year-olds, and it's tough for me to tell them reading's important and education's important and then to live in an area that doesn't have libraries. It was either do something about it or move or something. I didn't want to move. But I do agree with the point. This should be funded by taxes. I think the same thing.
Doug Walker of Josephine Community Libraries in Oregon. Well, we also heard from a lot of you after my tale of the broken thermometer, which to my chagrin brought out town firefighters to retrieve the mercury globules. Well, Susie Kinslow Byers of Tolan, Connecticut beats me for the most cautionary tale. She writes, in our case, there was a lot more mercury and my husband vacuumed it up. A no-no. We were told to get out of the house. Hazmat guys brought in huge fans to blow out the fumes. The vacuum cleaning put mercury into the air, so they turned down the thermostat to settle it. Our wall-to-wall carpeting was ripped up, an upholstered chair thrown out. We were tested and cleared and eventually allowed back in. But the moral of the story, never ever use the vacuum to clean up mercury. Yeesh, Susie, thank you. And as we learned, pick mercury up with masking tape and dispose of it at a hazardous material site like the ones set up by Bowling Green State University. David Heinlein, the safety director at Bowling Green, also wrote to tell us about their free mercury collection program throughout Ohio and 13 states. We'll link you at our website. And finally, many of you appreciated our talk with Greg Mortensen, author of 3 Cups of Tea, the story of how his failed mountain climb led to a lifelong commitment to build schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Greg's now advising the U.S. military, which thrilled many of his fans, including Stephen and Bonnie Barasoff, who thought we might be interested in what a couple of potters in Santa Cruz, California were doing to help Greg's work. And we are. Stephen, what are you doing?
Well, my wife read the book for a book club, and then she wanted to really do something, and she thought, well, you know, 3 cups of tea, cups, we're potters, we can make cups, we know other people who make cups. Let's see if we can do an auction, and that's going to happen this Saturday on Valentine's Day.
Do you remember what it was about his work that touched your wife and then you, because she made you read the book?
Well, it just seemed to make so much sense, and I've been saying for many years that the government was maybe misspending its money using military means to make friends and influence people around the world, when ultimately it just seems to have turned a lot of people against us. And Greg Mortensen's idea was to, you know, educate people and help children. And here's finally somebody who's doing something that we thought should have been done for years and decades.
Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, to find out more about Greg Mortensen's work, go to our website, here-now.org, where you can also find ways to contact us. And by the way, the song we're listening to comes from a companion CD to Greg's work. It's also called 3 Cups of Tea. You're listening to Here and Now. The slumping economy is hitting Valentine's Day. A survey by the National Retail Federation says, though we'll still be spending about $14.7 billion on our loved ones, spending is expected to drop more than $2 billion from last year. Well, if you'll be cutting back with a quiet Valentine's Day at home with dinner and a movie, or if that's where you traditionally are, we have Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr's suggestions. They are timeless, so we thought we'd reprise Ty's choices for best movies to get you in a romantic mood. And as we say every year, not that kind of movie. You brought with what you call, what, classics?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. They're romantic movies that stand the test of time.
Well, let's start with the first. Actually, there are two. Double feature, the 1995 film Before Sunrise, its sequel, the 2004 film Before Sunset, both starring Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy and directed by Richard Linklater. In the first, Before Sunrise, they play a young couple who just meet by chance on a train. He comes up with a plan. Let's listen.
I want to keep talking to you. You know, I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun.
And then he kills her. No?
No, sorry.
How nice.
He doesn't even sleep with her. They literally spend the night walking around, talking. It's one of the great, glorious, I'm young and I'm in love and I'm crazy and I'll stay up all night with you and we'll talk about all the incredibly important things in life because we're young and we're in love. It's a wonderful movie for that precise moment in time.
How wonderful. Before Sunrise with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. But then you also love the sequel, the 2004 film Before Sunset. The characters, Jesse and Celine, what's happened to them 9 years later?
Well, Jesse, the Ethan Hawke character, who's an American, has gone back. He's become a writer. He's written a novel about that night in Vienna. And he's come back to Paris to give a reading. And Celine, who lives in Paris, shows up at the book reading, as he sort of hoped she would. They haven't seen each other or spoken in 9 years. And they spend another lovely day, more measured, less insanely passionate, but fanning the embers of romance back into something like maybe a fire.
Well, we have a scene. This is where they meet again in the bookstore, as you said, for the first time in 9 years. He asks her about the book.
Did you have a chance to read it?
Yes, I was really, really surprised, as you can imagine. I mean, I had to read it twice, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Comme ci, comme ça?
No, I liked it.
Yeah?
It's very romantic. I usually don't like that, but it's really well written. It's really well written.
Thank you. Congratulations.
Both movies are about the way we talk when we're trying to talk ourselves into love, into attracting somebody else. But it's glorious dialogue, improvised in large part by the actors. They take credit for the screenplay along with Richard Linklater. And if Before Sunrise is a movie for young lovers, Before Sunset is a movie for people who've been around the block.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, you've got some films that have been around the block that have withstood the test of time. And you are a big fan of old black and white films, and you've written a book about old films to watch with young kids. But today you've brought some films to watch with someone you love. Let's start with 1945's I Know Where I'm Going. It stars Wendy Hiller as a headstrong young woman who travels to a Scottish island to marry a wealthy man. But in this scene, she meets a handsome young naval officer played by Roger Livesey. Let's listen.
Bad luck. No crossing today.
But isn't that the boat from Killoran?
No.
And if she was, it is not today she'd be getting back, my lady.
That's the ferry boat. Pity you didn't keep Ian's car, that's why I was shouting.
But we didn't understand. Why should I keep it anyway?
To go back to Tobermory and spend the night in a comfortable bed.
But I intend to spend the night on Killoran.
Oh.
But maybe something else is going to happen.
Well, there's that pesky fog that just keeps rolling in as if God himself were sort of pushing it along to keep her from going to the island. This is one of those movies like Local Hero about a person who shows up from the city, who knows where they're going and knows exactly what they want out of life and comes to a little magical place on the fringes of Scotland and is seduced by the magic of the place, by the light, by the locals, and of course by some special somebody there who's absolutely not what she's looking for in life, but you know, sometimes you don't make that choice.
Oh, it just sounds great. That's I Know Where I'm Going. We'll have the list for you, by the way, at our website, here-now.org. Now on to the 1940 film, The Shop Around the Corner, starring Jimmy Stewart, Margaret Sullivan, better known to some perhaps through the remake, starring Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, called You've Got Mail. You prefer the original. Why?
Oh, I think anybody who sees the original has to prefer the original because, well, for one thing, it's not about email. It's about letter writing, which is a lost art and a highly romantic art. For the other thing, it stars James Stewart with really the woman who was probably his best on-screen match, Margaret Sullivan. They were in a number of films together, and they really came together quite well in a way, you know, like Tracy had Hepburn. Mm-hmm. James Stewart had Margaret Sullivan. They really have sort of a privileged thing going on screen. And this is about two shop workers who hate each other, but they're secretly writing anonymous pen pal letters to each other through a service, much the way we would pick somebody up online today.
My heart was trembling as I walked into the post office, and there you were lying in box 237. I took you out of your envelope and read you right there.
And they fall in love in their letters while driving each other crazy in life. And it is about how those two spheres come together, how sometimes the person who drives you the most crazy is actually the person you love the most.
The Shop Around the Corner with Jimmy Stewart and Margaret Sullivan, again, just sounds terrific. Well, we want to move up again to 1990. Now, people might remember the 1990 film Ghost with Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore, a man who dies but can't bear to be separated from his wife even in death. You say that same year there was another film on the same topic that you'd rather talk about, Truly, Madly, Deeply, with Alan Rickman and Juliet Stevenson. Tell us a little bit about the film.
Well, it really, in a way, it's the thinking person's ghost. It's a British film. It stars Alan Rickman, who you know, everybody knows as villains from the Die Hard movies and as Snape in Harry Potter, but has, in his serious dramatic roles, he's just one of the most romantic people walking on the earth. And Juliet Stevenson is one of the great actresses of England. And here in 1990, they're young. They're playing a couple in love. He is unfortunately dead. They were married. They were happy. He dies in a stupid accident. And she is so bereft that he's got to come back. He has to come back and tend to her.
Tell me about the first night we spent together.
Why? Seriously? You want me to?
What did we do?
We talked.
What else?
Well, talking was the major component. You played that piano. Then I played. Then we both played something. Duet. Something. Can't remember. And then you danced for about 3 hours until I fell asleep. But you were fantastic. And then we had some cornflakes. And when we kissed, which was at about 11 o'clock the following morning, we were trembling so much we couldn't take off our clothes.
Oh, my.
And, you know, I'm telling you, it works.
Yeah, and in particular, you know, I'm thinking if you have had a loss, this might be something to really go to that place. Well, that's truly madly deeply. But what if, you know, you're out there and you don't care about Valentine's Day? You are determined to just curl up by yourself. Do you have a movie for someone like that, someone who hates Valentine's Day?
Oh, yeah, I would probably recommend Pandora's Box, the Louise Brooks silent classic about a completely amoral woman wreaking vengeance on men while having the time of her life. Yeah, it's silent. It's more modern than a lot of movies made today.
That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. Again, for his list of Valentine's Day picks, go to our website, here-now.org. And if you're spending the holiday with your kids, check out Ty's book, The Best Old Movies for Families, A Guide to Watching Together. It's terrific. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.